Many of the young people who created the counterculture of the 60s were raised in conventional middle-class families. When these young people became parents, they raised their own children in environments that violated many of the middle-class ideas of what constitutes a good home. And everyone wondered, what were these children going to be like when they grew up? Well, now they're adults, beginning to tell their stories. Lisa Michaels, for example, has just written a memoir called Split, A Counterculture Childhood. Her mother was a hippie. Her father was a member of the radical group The Weathermen, which believed that violence was justified in opposing an oppressive government. When Lisa Michaels was a child, she had to visit her father in prison, where he was serving time for assault and battery after an anti-war protest. Before that, her parents took her to an anti-war demonstration, and her picture ended up in Life magazine. Here's a reading about that from her book.
On the last page of the issue, under the heading Parting Shots, is a picture of me just shy of three, carrying an unfurled Viet Cong flag across a patch of trampled grass. I look highly serious, hunched over to counter the weight of the long pole, wearing a short dress and little brown work boots, a pint-sized protester, trudging along, head down, my chin slung forward in concentration. The editors at Life wrote a poem to go with the picture, which they called The Burden of Protest. Is toting a Viet Cong flag in a war demonstration the bag of a child or a parent? We'd say someone's errant. This kid should be off playing tag. It's a smarmy piece of copy. Never a good idea to take the moral high ground in a limerick. Notably, the poem took a pot shot at my mother, who to the editor's mind was conspicuously absent, having loaded me up with my ideological burden and disappeared. But my mother says she was there that day, and the picture lied. I had picked up the flag on my own. She can almost recite the doggerel from memory. That poem was a criticism of my parenting, she said once with a laugh. Some mothers were worried about stuff going on at those rallies, but me, a nice girl from the suburbs, I was a trusting soul. I came to pick you up from your dad, and there you were dancing around with that flag. Your dress, you can't see this from the picture because it's black and white, was red velvet, a real thick velvet, and some part of the flag was red, and you looked gorgeous. They found one shot where you seemed burdened, but really you were having a blast, and the photographer knew it. The first time I saw this picture was in my father's house. I must have been 8 or so. He had trimmed away the offending poem, framed the photo in matboard, and typed his own caption. I can't reconstruct his text entire because the picture was lost in some move, but his final line sticks in my head. Could it be that at 3 you caught the spirit of the worldwide movement for socialism and shouted, "Hey, everybody, wait for me"?
Lisa Michaels, what did your father's caption on this photo say to you about what he wanted you to be when you were a child at this anti-war rally?
Well, I think it was a fairly loving gesture on his part, but I think that he wanted to see me as a comrade in arms, and he was very proud of my going along with him to these rallies and us being sort of a political family. So I found it slightly ironic as an adult. As a child, I felt sort of proud to be framed and hung on the wall, but even then, I think I registered a little bit that he had missed the mark slightly, at least about my consciousness about politics at that time.
Yeah, do you have any actual memories of that day?
Absolutely none.
I'm wondering what the anti-war events that you were taken to as a child looked like to you then, perhaps when you were a little bit older, events that you actually have some memories of. Are there any demonstrations that you remember?
Yeah, I have sort of specific memories of certain rallies that we went to when I was 8, 9, 10. I enjoyed going to them when they were going well, as long as there were lots of us and people were honking when they drove by. But when it was sort of a slim turnout and I felt we were outnumbered, I always wished that I was somewhere else. Basically, I would try to slink back into the middle of the line and, sort of carry my sign low.
You know, for a lot of kids, their memories are more of, getting taken by their parents to shop for linoleum or something like that, you know? So I'm wondering if you had the same, oh, do I have to go, Ma, kind of attitude that kids often have when they're taken to an event that means something to the parents and not much to the kids.
Oh, definitely. I felt like I was supposed to go to, you know, be supportive, basically, but it wasn't my idea of fun most of the time. A lot of the conversations and speeches went over my head, and often it was hot and you were sitting out in some parking lot. But like I said, every now and then I did catch some kind of spirit that was going on in the crowd. I really liked the Internationale. It was one of my favorite songs when I was little. And if there were a lot of us and everybody was singing, I could get really righteous about the cause.
Your parents were married in 1964. They separated when you were about 4 months old. And so before you had any consciousness at all, they had to decide how to share parenting responsibilities. What do you know about the early arrangements they came up with and their thinking behind those arrangements?
Well, they were sort of novel in the way they arranged their divorce at the time. Now it's quite commonplace, but at the time people were complimenting them on how fair-minded and sort of enlightened it was. They would split the week. My mother would take me 3 days and my father four, vice versa. And I think for a while it really worked well for them. They both had a lot of freedom, and, you know, taking care of a very small child is really intensive, and it was probably nice to get a three-day vacation once a week.
When did that arrangement start to fall apart?
Well, my dad got more and more involved in this radical politics, and I think that he started to feel that he couldn't keep up those activities and take care of me at the same time. And there was a sort of historic battle in their relationship about which they're still not completely in agreement, where my father said that he felt that he needed to devote himself to bettering the world for all children, and that that was a more important goal in the short term than taking care of me. And my father feels that that conversation was very much a conversation between two people who agreed about the goal, if not the means. My mother claims to have felt fairly abandoned at that moment and feeling that it was fairly self-indulgent, but since I was too small to remember, I just have to take their word for it.
After your parents separated, your mother later found a man who became her husband, a man named Jim, and he had a mail truck, and the three of you took off in the mail truck to find a new home, and for a while you actually lived in the truck. Now, a lot of people in the 60s had this experience of, you know, traveling long distances and living in a van, and some of those people had children like you. I'm really interested in hearing what it was like from your perspective as a child to live out of a van for a while. It could be something of an adventure. For the adults, how did it feel to you as a kid?
I think that that was a slightly difficult time for me in a way. I think that, I mean, especially as I got older, I certainly felt this way, and I feel quite sure that I felt that way then, that I wanted a really simple, normal life. I wanted us to have an address, and I wanted kids across the street that I could play with. And so I think it was kind of a hard time to be rootless, although I have lots of photographs of myself living in the mail truck, and I'm always smiling and happy. So I have this kind of disconnect between, you know, there were obviously good times, and I had two parents who were with me all the time, who never went to work, and there were no have-tos in any particular day. They would just drive around and say, should we go to the Okefenokee Swamp? Well, why not? And hang out with me. So I think that must have been pleasurable. But I can remember feeling vulnerable sometimes. I slept in the front of the truck on this foam mattress that went on the engine cover, and I didn't like being out there in the cab. Sounds so funny now, a child's complaint. I didn't like sleeping in the cab of the truck. I wanted to be in the back where they were, which seemed slightly more secure. And once in a while, we'd be parked on a residential street, and there was some question about whether we were going to be asked to move because people didn't quite like the idea of some hippies living out of a truck in their neighborhood. So, you know, it had its vulnerabilities. It also had its freedoms. And I think that's true of most of my childhood, that kind of dichotomy.
What kind of neighborhood did you end up settling in?
Well, my parents drove around in the truck and one day rumbled down this road in this really tiny farming town in Northern California and just fell in love with the place. So we lived in this town of about 2,000 people, most of them ranchers, farmers, people who worked in the lumber mills. And it was a fairly conservative community in a way, although there was a sort of speckling of other back-to-the-landers living there, most of them East Coast transplants like my parents.
Now, some people with unconventional parents grow up in communities where many of the other kids' parents are equally unconventional. So the parents actually appear to be kind of average. But it sounds like the parents around you were actually living lives that were much more conventional than your parents' lives. How did your parents look to you compared to the rest of the community? And did you want them to be like everybody else?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, when we lived on the road, in a way, I was spared from that kind of comparison because we were just this little traveling universe and I didn't have any other families to hold up as models for how to live. But when we landed in this town, I suddenly became really aware that, you know, I wore these hippie clothes and my mother picked me up from school in a mail truck, not a woody station wagon. And then I began this campaign to try and reform them, and I wanted my mother to wear capri pants and makeup, and I, you know, felt sort of self-conscious when we would have field trips. My mother would always volunteer to drive because, Lord, we had lots of room in the truck, and I would sort of cringe and hope that some other mother would volunteer. But, of course, all my friends thought it was funny and enjoyed riding in it and thought it was kind of a kick. I had a certain self-consciousness that was probably out of proportion to what anybody else thought of me.
My guest is Lisa Michaels. Her new memoir is called Split, A Counterculture Childhood. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Lisa Michaels. She's written a new memoir called Split, A Counterculture Childhood. Were there any things that your parents did that you found really difficult to explain to your friends?
Well, they were really unconcerned about manners, at least like the kind of petty manners that they thought weren't really important. I mean, I shouldn't say
the bourgeois conventions.
Yeah, exactly. Like, you know, what fork are you supposed to use and do you keep your left hand in your lap? And we were all big readers in the family, so when we ate dinner, it was if everybody had something good to read, then we would just read through dinner. You'd tuck your book under the edge of your plate and we were all content. But then I realized at a certain point when I went over to other people's house that I didn't know what I was supposed to be doing, so I forced them to have manners night once a week where they would show me, you know, how to lay my napkin across my lap and so forth. They thought that was really a hoot because they couldn't wait to, you know, get away from all that kind of stuff.
Your parents were coming of age during the sexual revolution, and so their standards about sexuality were very different from their own parents' standards and very different from a lot of the people around them who weren't part of the counterculture. When you started to come of age, your mother gave you some advice about what to do when you were ready to have an intimate encounter. Would you pass on for us what your mother suggested?
Well, she was always very frank with me about sex from the get-go. I remember being always the one in elementary school who was explaining to the other kids how the anatomy worked. And I don't even remember hearing that information from her. It was almost like I just absorbed it by osmosis. She must have talked to me about those things before I had any self-consciousness about them. But when it came time, when I was in high school and, you know, she was aware that sex was on the horizon, she came to me and said that when I was ready, she really didn't want me having sex in the back seat of a car, that sex was a good thing, it was wholesome and healthy, and I could come to her with my date and tell her that I was ready to enter the world of sexual congress, and they would show me to the bedroom, which I was mortified by.
With some birth control. They'd also help
you
get birth control.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah, she would get me some birth control, and she just wanted it to be a positive experience, but I think she didn't see the sort of thicket between us and the way in which adolescents need to sort of shield themselves from their parents.
What was your reaction when she said, and you quote this in the book, that when you're ready to make love, we'll make sure you get some birth control and some privacy, you know, assuming that you and your date come and talk with her first?
Well, I also felt quite sure that my stepfather would have gotten out the shotgun and warned the guy off the property, and I wasn't wrong about that. Later, I heard that he was really opposed to this policy, but I was really embarrassed and mortified at the time when my mother brought this up, and I just couldn't imagine any date, any 16-year-old that I knew being willing to show up for such an encounter.
So how did you handle it?
Well, the usual way, finding, you know, some car, some abandoned house where the parents weren't home. Poor mother. She hoped for the best for me.
You know, a lot of people grow up watching their parents go to work, often at jobs that they don't find particularly rewarding. And then the children often think, when I grow up, I'm going to try to have work I love. I'm going to try to, you know, live a freer life. Now, your father spent has spent a good deal of his working life as a labor organizer, and doing industrial work to earn a living while he tried to organize the industry. And I'm wondering how that left you feeling. I think made a lot of sacrifices to do that work that he really believed in. What did it make you feel about life as an adult and the kind of sacrifices, you know, one makes to do work that they feel idealistic about?
Well, I definitely absorbed that ideal from my parents of, you know, working for love, not for money. I'd say it's the one area of my life that I can very plainly say I didn't react against them, but rather took them as my models. Both my mother and my father worked at very low-paying jobs that they were very passionate about, and it made me feel free when I came of age and I graduated from college. I didn't get any kind of pressure about what's your plan, you know, what's your career going to be. They just sort of watched what I was going to do next with this very open and tolerant attitude. And I do think in some ways one of the reasons I felt free to try and be a writer was that I had their example of doing what they loved and not worrying about putting money in their IRA.
Well, Lisa Michaels, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thanks for having me.
Lisa Michaels' new memoir is called Split, A Counterculture Childhood.